It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimeras Comics. Chimeras is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimeras Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Thank you, this is Caffeinated Comics. I'm your host, John Clark. The new movie, Batman vs. Robin, is out direct to DVD. It's Warner Brothers' latest animated version of the DC Universe. They've put out about 20 of them in the last 7 years, so it's a fairly regular thing. But what's not regular is how good this is. This movie is an adaptation of three or four different sources, and yet it feels like one complete whole. And one of the reasons it feels like one complete whole is because of J.M. DeMatteis. Now, if longtime listeners will remember, J.M. and I talked last year. He's the writer of Kraven's Last Hunt and Justice League International and Moonshadow and such great comics, but one of the things he also does is work in television. He's written a lot of Justice League Unlimited and Brave and the Bold and this new film. I was really impressed with the way it came out. I enjoyed talking to JM last time, so when I asked him if he wanted to go into detail about this and his upcoming comic project, it happened pretty quickly. And once again, I think it's a really interesting conversation, so let's get to it.
Anything within reason.
Well, now I don't know what your definition of reason is.
Right. Well, you'll discover it when you ask a question that's beyond reason. I'll let you know.
Yeah, I really don't want this to be the Robert Downey Jr. interview.
No, it's not. I don't think it's going to be. Don't worry about it.
So JM, we know that these DC animated movies are planned well in advance. When you're called in to do Batman versus Robin, how much do they have, and then how much are you adding?
You know, when writing for television, writing for film is, it's the old cliche, but it's true, it's a collaborative medium. And I often say to people, there's one hat that I wear. If I'm writing a book, if I'm writing a comic book, even in comics, you know, when you're working on established characters, when you're hired on a book, most of the time you're hired to pursue your own vision and pursue your own storylines. When you're working in television, when you're working in film, you're hired to be part of the team to execute, ultimately 9 times out of 10 or 19 times out of 20, to execute their vision, and then to bring your vision to add to their vision. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Because you're the one who's expressing it on the page. But so I take off my I am the writer hat when I work on a film or a TV thing, and then I put on my I am the collaborator hat. Mm-hmm. As long as I have that collaborator hat on, I'm fine, and I have a great time. If my hats get mixed up, my head's going to get screwed up, you know what I mean? Because if I think it's like, you know, I joke, like, you know, take a show I've written for, like Thundercats. You know, I'm not going to go in with like, and here is my vision of what Thundercats should be. You know, it doesn't work that way, you know, and it shouldn't work that way. The producers are in charge of the show. The producers have their vision of what the show is. And when you get hired to write an episode of something, or even, you know, lots of shows I've written many episodes of, 7, 8 episodes of a given series, you're still, and I don't mean in a negative way, you're dancing to their tune. It's up to you to come up with some really great footwork, but it's their tune. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And so working on a movie like this, you know, they call me up and they say, we want to do this. We want to, you know, we're going to go to the Court of Owls story. We're going to go to this story. We want to pull these elements together. Here's the basics of what it's about. And then we get on the phone and we start to bounce ideas around. Now, the great thing is with these animated movies, the guys that are in charge of the, you know, the DCU animated stuff, you've got Alan Burnett, you've got James Tucker, and you've got Mike Carlin. Those are the three guys that I work with, you know?
And they're all, guys you know well, because I know you've done a lot of Brave and Bold.
James and Alan from the animation world, from working on these shows, and Carlin I know from the first day practically that he started working at Marvel, you know, back in the 80s. So there's a lot of history there. and I respect them all. You know, it's not like, you know, sometimes you can work on movies and you get notes from people, and it's some executive who passes it down to the producer, or some executive who passes it down to an executive who passes it down to a producer. You know what I mean? Then it gets to you, and it's like, what? You know? But I'm working, like, on this movie, to be specific, with these three guys, all of whom are really smart, and each of whom, in their own right, is a really good writer. So I got nothing to complain about. You walk in the door, A, knowing that I'm going to be a collaborator, and B, that I really respect the people I'm working with. So I'm not going in with my defenses up, trying to fight and trying to say, no, it has to be this way, or no, it has to. And they're not being that way either. They're very open. They're very collaborative. And I have to say, this particular project, out of all the, you know, I've done a lot of, not just out of animation work, this was one of the most fun projects I've ever worked on, period. From the first day they called me to the last day of the last draft, it was just a pleasure. I don't know why it was. It just worked out that way. You know, we talked about the story. We talked it through. I went and I wrote my outline. And the way it goes is then I go home. You know, we come up with the basics. I go home. I write a very detailed outline. And then the outline goes through several drafts. I'll say, well, what about that? We don't know if we like that, if that works. Well, what about this? What about it bounces around and you go through a few drafts of the outline? But at no point in the process did I get a bad note. I think there was one time there was one note and I went, I don't know how I feel about that. And they went, so don't do it. You know, that was our big conflict on this project. And I'm not exaggerating. It was just a pleasure from beginning to end.
Well, and
which these kind of things are not always like that, you know? And very often you'll see in television or movies, you know, a writer's name is on a project and you'll find five words that you wrote on the screen, you know, by the time they're done. And the joke is sometimes you'll find five words on the screen that you wrote and they'll still call you up and say they loved what you did and hire you for the next thing because the reasons that they changed it had nothing to do with you. It had to do with budget. It had to do with some notes from some executive. It had to do with 10,000 other factors and they end up having to rewrite it, but they still loved what you did and they hire you the next time. But on this one, it was just a very fun, open, collaborative process. And when I finally got to see it, I went, oh, there's a lot of stuff in there that's mine. It's like, I read those words. That's pretty good, you know. So it was a nice experience. We just had the premiere at WonderCon a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, nice.
And over 4,000 people showed up for this thing.
Were you able to attend that?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Oh, yeah, it was great. You know, we had Jason O'Mara and several of the other voice actors and Andrea Romano and Jay Oliva, who's the director, and James Tucker was there, and we did press all day, and then we had this big premiere of 4,000 people, more than 4,000 people, and then we did a panel right after the screening, and it was just really a tremendous amount of fun. We had a great time.
That's great. I really want to walk through the process of this because, as you said, you're putting on your collaborator hat rather
right.
than your writer hat. So how familiar were you with Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo's Court of Owls, for example, before you started this?
Not in the least. But, you know, then they send you a big stack of books and you read through it and you go, oh, this is cool. This is really, you know. So but I had no, I'm not, you know, I was not up on it at all. I had no idea.
And you know,
I knew that Scott Snyder was doing Batman, but that's as much of it as I knew. I had never read the Court of Owls story, knew nothing about it. But, you know, years ago I adapted For the Man Who Has Everything, for Justice League Unlimited, the Alan Moore story.
Oh, yeah, that's a great comic and a good episode.
And I don't think I'd ever read it before they asked me to adapt it. So I somehow missed that one somewhere. And then I read it and went, wow, what a great story. You know, it was just kind of the same experience here. The Court of Owls is just a very cool concept. And I understand exactly why they wanted to do it, because it's just very cool. And there was another storyline, and I always forget what the other one was, that they pulled in. And I'll remember it once we're done having this conversation. And there were elements of the other story. And then what we did was, the great thing was that we decided from the get-go, this is not an adaptation of Court of Owls. We didn't do an adaptation. What they said was, we can use these elements in our story. Use what we want, throw out what we don't want, because our story wasn't the Court of Owls. Our story was about Bruce Wayne and Damian, you know? Right. And I know there's a Grant Morrison story called arc called Batman versus Robin, but that didn't even come into it. You know, there were a couple of Grant Morrison elements that we brought in, but I'd never read the Batman versus Robin arc. They just picked that title. You know, I only found out after the fact that there had been a story called Batman versus Robin. You know, so really this was about taking these elements and then creating our own story on top of it. And essentially at its heart and soul, it's a story about the last man in the world who is really should ever be a father, and in a lot of weird ways, the last kid in the world who ever is equipped, who's the most ill-equipped person in the world to be a son, you know? And how do these two people come together, and can they even come together? And that's the thing for me. You know, I've worked on projects where we're pulling elements and we're doing this and we have all these cool ideas, and I can't find the emotional through line, you know what I mean? No matter how much I struggle with it, like, so what is this about? What's the emotional core? That's always, for me, the single most important and interesting part of a story. You can have all the fancy, fancy dancing and fancy dressing and on the salad, you know, and all that. But if you don't have that emotional core, you're lost. And this story, it was really simple because the emotional core was really clear. There was Bruce and there was Damien. That was the heart and soul. Then you have this other really strong push-pull relationship with the town and Damien. You brought in Dick for that whole brotherly thing going on. So there were a lot of really strong emotional currents on the story. And in talking about it now, I'm seeing maybe that's why I found this to be such a almost, when I say effortless, I don't mean it wasn't hard work. It's always hard work writing, you know? But it was hard work the way that, you know, when you watch an ice skater and they're like so graceful and they're spinning around on the ice and it looks effortless. And you know they're working hard and they had to learn their skills, and yet there's something magical and effortless. And this project kind of felt like that. It felt like just skating, you know? And I think it's because there was such a strong emotional core to the story. And then, you know, that was, you know, I'm running through terrible metaphors here. That was the cake, you know? And the Court of Owls and all that other stuff was the icing, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's very cool, so it's really cool icing. But the cake was those relationships.
Right. And as you said, that emotional core is really clear in the film. And sometimes that's not always the case in these. They become such big blockbusters or adaptations that you lose that.
But right.
I was really happy to see it was always front and center.
Yes.
And with Batman and Damien, who is a fairly new character, as you said, you didn't really know the Court of Owls. How familiar were you with Damian Wayne before this?
Not really. You know, I knew he existed.
More than Court of Owls.
Yeah, it's the same kind of thing. Like, I was aware of Damien. I knew the basic premise of Damien. I don't know if I'd ever even read any stories featuring Damien until they sent me that stack of books. And it's interesting because I have a real problem with the whole kid sidekick thing, and always have, you know? And I think the clever thing that Grant Morrison did was by making him this kid that was raised by Ra's al Ghul in the Court of the League of Assassins, so that even though he's 10 years old, he's like, you know, this master assassin who could take on virtually anybody. It was a clever way to sidestep the issue, you know? Because really, when you think about it, I made this joke when we did our panel, but I said the next movie should really be called Batman Social Services. Because, you know, it's like, Mr. Wayne, you know, that one kid died and the other one, you know, it's like, the idea of a kid's sidekick, that a thinking adult would take a young boy out into the world and take him and let's go fight the Joker. 12-year-old kid, you know what I mean?
And at this point, he's done it with four different black-haired children.
Right, you know, and really, it's insane. Now, the magic is the entire superhero universe, if you take a half step back, you know, you look at it a certain way, it's insane. But the reality that we create on the page allows you to believe it. And that's why we have believed in Robin all these years. And that's why, though, you know, if when you do these things in live action, when they did that goofy, what was it, Batman and Robin movie some years ago, they at least Robin was like 20.
Right.
You know, you can't if you. I think they would even have trouble with Damien, even with the backstory, if doing it live action, because the minute you see a 10-year-old kid up there, He's a 10-year-old kid. On the comic book page, it works. In animated form, it works. But I think if you did it in live action, it would not work at all. And imagine now, in a contemporary Batman movie, him running around with one of the classic Robins, with Dick Grayson when he was 12 or 13. It would seem insane.
Right. And you have to point to Chris O'Donnell in Batman and Robin as the last time they did it, which is almost 20 years ago.
Right.
Because every other film has sidestepped it to the point right. where in the last film, Joseph Gordon-Levitt was just a little wink to the right. audience that, oh, his name is Robin, but he wasn't actually a Robin.
Right, exactly. But as I said, Grant Morrison did a very clever thing by creating this particular Robin and sidestepped a lot of that issue. But still, I have to say there was a moment of shock after writing, because, you write these characters and you hear voices in your head. And I know intellectually he's 10 years old, but I'm writing him like he's 15, 16, Mm-hmm. So the first time I saw a clip from the film before it came out, and I heard an age-appropriate voice came out, and Stuart, oh God, I forgot Stuart's last name, who did the voice, just a great job, and he's a really nice kid. I got to meet him at WonderCon, a really nice kid. But the first time I heard a kid's voice come out of his mouth, it really threw me, and then I adjusted to it. But it's to Grant Morrison's great credit that he found a way to make this work, and that Damian is such a fascinating character. And you see it comes up in the movie. It's like they say, oh, he's just a kid. But he's not a kid. But he's just a kid. But he's not like any kid that you've ever met before, And so there's this constant push-pull, even with Batman and with Dick, where they're trying to, they can't quite wrap their heads around Damian, because he's a 10-year-old boy, except he's like no other 10-year-old boy that's ever existed on the planet. So it's fascinating. And then the other great thing that the character brings to the table is you have a character like Batman who's been around for 75 years, and as writers, we're always looking for new ways to pry open his skull and shine a new light in some corner of his psyche we haven't been before. And now you've got this kid who's not just a Robin, this is his son, this is his flesh and blood. He's literally a father now, trying to figure out how to be a father. Well, we've never seen that before. So to have anything with Batman and say we've never seen that before is really a great thing. So that opens up whole other layers in the emotional resonances, in Batman's world. And that was another thing that I think really, really helped to make that emotional through line. As much as we've seen his relationship with Dick Grayson and the push-pull with that over the years, it's still not the same as his son. This is his son, I have to be a father. And for Damian, it's the same journey. Well, I have to be a son. Do I really want to be a son? Can I be a son? Can this man love me? Do I even know what love is? All that stuff is the subtext beneath all this, and it's fascinating.
Right. Now, it sounds like you found a really quick way into the characters, even characters you weren't familiar with. Obviously, you're very familiar with Batman.
Right.
Do you have to take a different approach? Other than the relationship with Damian, would you say the Batman you wrote in this movie is the same Batman you've written in the comics, or is it a version that fits within that film world?
Well, what's interesting about Batman and what I love about Batman is I've written a lot of Batman over the years. I think it was last year was the 75th anniversary, and I was looking through all the stuff I've written, and I always said, I've written a few Batman stories. I've written a lot of Batman. The first superhero story I was ever paid for when I first started in the business, Paul Levitz hired me to write a Batman coloring book. And then I wrote the first actual comic book superhero story was a little short 10-page Batman story in Detective Comics, And then so many different Batman stories, not to mention in animated form in Justice League Unlimited, and seven episodes of Batman Brave and the Bold. And I went, oh my God, I've written a ton of Batman over the years. There was just a lot of stories, and I didn't realize. The great thing about the character is it's not always the same Batman. The Batman in Justice League International is not the Batman. I did a Batman graphic novel called Absolution, mm-hmm. which wasn't exactly the same Batman in a Batman Two-Face story that I did. Batman can stay rooted in his essential Batman-ness, if there's such a word as Batman-ness. There is now, and yet play so many different ways, the Batman I really like is not the obsessed lunatic, violent vigilante who's trying to punish everybody for killing his mommy and daddy. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The Batman that I really like is the guy that went through this trauma and felt that way and came out the other end. My favorite Batman story that I ever wrote was for Legends of the Dark Knight. It was called Going Sane.
Oh, yeah, and, that's a great
and, story. I think it's actually one of the best mainstream superhero stories I've ever done. I'm very proud of that story. And Batman in that is not a whack job. And in fact, part of his arc in that story is kind of remembering that he's not. And that really, I see his role in Gotham as in a weird way picking up from his father, who was a doctor. He too is a healer, and Gotham is the patient, you know, and he's not a psychopath. Although I've written Batman the Psychopath, too. And he's kind of interesting in his own way, too. But I don't necessarily buy into that guy, you know. Now, this Batman is a fairly dark Batman. And yet, again, because of Damian, there are other aspects of him that we're seeing here. And the truth is, you know, we know that he can't really be that thing. Because forgetting all the things I said about that don't work about Robin, the fact that this guy has had Robins in his life means that he's not the isolated psychopathic loner. He's someone who needs companionship. You know, there's a whole family of Batman characters that he's involved with, not to mention the Justice League. And no matter how much we say, oh, he's the one apart, he's been part of these things. That was one of the great things about, you know, Batman and Justice League Unlimited, was playing him in such a way that he stayed as Batman-y as possible. We have Batman-ness, and now we have Batman-y. We have two new words. And yet, he was always in on the joke. I knew whenever I wrote him that he loved being part of that Justice League. He loved Beetle and Booster and all their stupidity. He couldn't come out and say it. He had to play the stern school teacher, but he loved it. And so I think Batman, the Batman that I love and try to write, has that humanity's always there. It may be masked, literally and figuratively, but it's always there.
Right. And you can't say that about many characters. I mean, you've written a lot of Spider-Man, but you can't say that there's many different Spider-Mans.
Right. There. I think, yeah, it's interesting because with Spider-Man, it's sort of like there's the essential Peter Parker, mm-hmm. or the character's wrong.
Right. Yeah, it's either Stan Lee's Spider-Man or right. It's not Spider-Man.
Right. Well, he has other dimensions. Obviously, like the Spider-Man that we saw in Kraven's Last Hunt, it was darker, but it was still Peter. It was still essentially true to the core of Peter. And so he doesn't have that broad path that Batman does, where he's open to so many interpretations and yet remains essentially Batman, you know?
Yeah, what do you think it is about Batman? Because I actually can't name any character as malleable as him.
Yeah.
What do you think it is about his appeal that you can change him without breaking him, whereas with someone like Spider-Man, who's as universally loved, there's a right way and a wrong way. What is it that...
Right.
How does Batman break those rules?
You know, it's almost, and I think Superman does to a certain degree too, because if you go back to, you know, early Superman and then 50s Superman, and then there's definitely, it's not as broad as Batman, but there's a big difference between that scrappy guy from the 40s who was punching out wife beaters and getting the army to chase him through the metropolis slums so that he could bring down the slums and get new housing for people, you know? And then the clean and squeaky 1950s, early 60s Superman. So there have been different interpretations, not as broad as Batman. But I think the thing with both of those characters is that they're sort of archetypes from our collective unconscious, you know? I have this theory that with a lot of what we now look at in pop culture, I feel the same way about Mickey Mouse, you know? Everybody knows, you don't need to have ever seen a Mickey Mouse cartoon to know who he is. You don't need to have ever read a Batman comic book or seen anything about him to know him. And Superman, especially. Superman is this universal archetype. And I feel like, you know, thousands of years ago, people had certain gods that fulfilled the same function in the collective unconscious and the collective psyche that Superman does, that Batman does, that even Mickey Mouse does, and that these things that we project out from our collective unconsciousness take different forms. And so that maybe Batman is one of those universal archetypes that keeps evolving through the centuries in different forms, whereas I don't necessarily think Spider-Man is. Now, Spider-Man is one of my favorite characters of all time, but I don't think he's a universal archetype. I don't think he's crawled out of the collective unconscious in quite the same way, you know? And Batman really has, and Superman really has, you know? And it's funny, I keep coming back to Mickey Mouse, but to me, Mickey Mouse is like I think we all agree that when we see Mickey Mouse, it has something to do with imagination, with play, playfulness and imagination. It's almost like the god of imagination. And in, for our culture, he's taken the form of this cartoon mouse, you know? Mm-hmm. And Batman has crawled out of the same sort of soup in our collective unconscious. And maybe that's why he can be interpreted in many different ways.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's one of the things I love most about that character. As I said, it's so hard to do a Batman story that's not right because it's so broad. But going back from comics to animation,
sure.
How involved are you in staging the action in a way? In a comic, you would be writing a full script or a plot and leaving it to the artists.
Let me just back that up because. Yeah, you don't really, you know, you can leave it to the artist. You want to leave the artist room, but you really try when you have a fight sequence to choreograph those fights. You really do. Now, in a comic book, to just go, there's a fight, which, you know, has been done in a plot. Here, if there's a fight for the next 3 pages. Here are the big beats. You figure the rest out. But I really, and I'm sure there were times early in my career when I did the same thing. But for the most part, I like to choreograph the fights and say, this is what happens, this is what happens. You know, panel by panel, here's what's going on. So with animation, the thing is you have another step here. So I can't just say fight scene, you know, in an animation script. I have to work it out, you know. And if there are camera moves that are important, I have to put them in. It has to be very precise. But then it goes to the director. And the director's job is to take everything that I did and blow it up big, you know? And I'm always amazed over the years with all the animation work I've done to see some sequence that I wrote that maybe it was a couple of pages of a fight. I remember years ago working on Justice League Unlimited, and there was a big fight between Superman and Captain Marvel. And I had a lot of fun writing it. It was sort of appealed to the 12-year-old in my psyche. Superman, Captain Marvel, and they're fighting, oh my God! You know, and I wrote this really cool, fun fight sequence. And then I saw the final episode, and they took that, and it got 10 times bigger than anything on the page, because that's what the director does, and that's the fun that they have. And it was very much the same thing. Jay Oliva is known for his action sequences, you know? And he did an amazing job of taking these things and just making them spectacular. Really spectacular. And I have to be honest, far more violent than anything on that page. You know? There was some stuff I went, oh my God, really? You know? But that doesn't mean that I get to be lazy. I have to work these things out because, you know, in the best of all possible worlds, these fights are reflections of what's going on inside the characters, you know? So they have to be reflective of the emotional state. And you have to choreograph them on the page. You also have to know, though, while you're choreographing them on the page, that somebody else is going to come along and storyboard it and do something different with it. And hopefully what you get is what's on the page inspires the director to take it even farther and play with it even more.
Right. So it sounds like what you're saying is that you have it all planned out and what they're doing is enhancing it rather than going a different direction with it.
Right. And you know, sometimes, you know, they probably do go into a different direction. But, you know, I don't think they did anything in this movie where suddenly it was something that had nothing to do with what I wrote on the page, you know. Mm-hmm. They just made it bigger, you know, and they're fighting on the roof. Or this happens, the next thing you know, they've fallen off the roof. And this, it, once the director's done with it, and they've crashed into this, or they've done that. They just make it bigger. Right. And you know, it's their job to make it as visually interesting as possible. And Jay really did. He did a great job doing that.
And so usually when you finish the script and you've handed it in, you've done all your revisions, is that the last you see it before it premieres?
That's certainly the last I saw of it, yeah.
So now
here's the difference. Here's the difference. I live in New York. They're in L.A. If I was in L.A., I would probably go to the voice sessions and sit in and be a part of that in some way. I would love to do that. I've only gotten to do that once with an episode of Brave and the Bold, and it was really so much fun to sit there and watch these actors do what they do, you know? But I'm 3,000 miles away, so I'm not out there when they're doing the voices. So I miss out on that part. If I was out there, I think the involvement perhaps would go on a bit more. But in general, though, once I'm done, It's up to the director. It's the director's job to take it from there, and then you know there's always at the you know there are things that come up. So I'm done, But maybe they decide, oh, you know what? This sequence isn't going to work, or it's going to be too expensive to do that. And then so there's always going to be some sort of production rewrite that goes on once it's out of my hands too. So that's where I say you have to detach your ego from it and know that you're part of the team. And with a movie like this where so much of what I put on the page is there, it's really great. There, like I said, there are other experiences where virtually nothing that you put on. I've written for live action too, and there was one series that shall remain nameless that I wrote for. And, you know, the show came on, and it was like, so where's the stuff I wrote? And that was one of those shows where they actually loved what I did and hired me again. And the reason that they had to change all this stuff is because the production designer couldn't do this, or something came up with this actor about that, and they just had to change everything, and they had to get this thing out, and out it went. So it's a funny business that way. I think if that's all that one did was write for the screen, at least as a freelancer, that's the thing too. As a freelancer, you're, say on a TV show, you're being hired, as I said, to execute somebody else's vision. You want to bring your vision to the table and add as much of it as you can. You never want to do anything less than your absolute best and put your heart and soul into it. But unless you're on staff, and ultimately unless you're one of the people producing the show and it's your vision, that's when you're in control. And that's when your vision gets to the screen. Everybody else is helping to execute the producer's vision, really, in television. And then, you know, film, it gets into different things. You know, you can sell a spec screenplay, which is completely your vision. And by the time they're done with it, you know, the studio purchases it, someone else comes along and rewrites your vision. And so it's a funny world. It's a funny world. The upshoot is that you get to reach a lot of people, a lot more than you're ever going to reach in comics. Even a low-rated TV show, you can reach millions of people, literally millions of people. And that's a great thing. That's a really great thing. But you have to check your ego at the door and know that you're a collaborator. Unless in film you also become a director, or in TV you also become a producer. Otherwise, take a deep breath, be part of the team. And then if you're lucky with a movie like this where everything comes out in balance, where you really, really do see your contribution up on the screen, that's a great thing.
Well, and speaking of executing a producer's vision, I just saw in the solicitations for DC you're going to be working on the comics for the next DC animated movie.
Yeah, this Gods and Monsters that Bruce Timm came up with.
Right. So now, what is that collaboration like? Because the movie isn't even finished yet.
Right, but I've seen a rough of the movie, so I know exactly what's going on, and you know, you get scripts and you get everything else. This is similar to that, but also a little different. There's a little more leeway, a little more fun. But the bottom line is, this is Bruce Timm created the universe. Alan Burnett wrote the script for the movie, but it's Bruce's universe. And so whatever goes on with these comics, in the end, if Bruce says, nah, I don't want it to be that way, it's not going to be that way, because these are his characters and his universe. That said, I've had a lot of leeway and a lot of fun working with these characters, because what we're doing is, you know, the movie takes place in a certain time frame. This is a prequel. So it's Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, but it is a Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman that we've never seen before. I can't say too much about it, right, since it hasn't come out yet. It's a different universe. It's a different Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman. And what we're doing are three spotlight issues, one for each of those characters. And then we're doing a three-issue origin of this Justice League, because when you meet them in the movie, they're already the Justice League. So we're doing the origin. So it's really, really fun. So I'm getting to add a lot to this mythos and to this universe that Bruce has created. And the creative process has been very similar to TV, even with the fact that Mike Carlin, because he is the guy who's the liaison between the worlds of comics and DC animation, you know, Mike's been involved. So I get on the phone with Bruce and Mike and our editor, Christy Quinn, and we just start to talk, you know, well, what do we want? What do you want? What do you want from here? What do you guys want to do here? And then we start bouncing around ideas, and I go off and I write and I add things and I change things. And then I get notes on my outline, and then I go and I write the plots. I get some notes on the plot. I adjust it to what it is that Bruce wants. But there's been a lot of freedom in this to really explore these characters and poke into them and find out who they are and reveal things about them that we don't get to see in the movie, so that this miniseries is really important to these characters, not just like a little knockoff miniseries. We really are establishing, we're getting origin stories on these characters in the comics that we don't really get. we get origins in the movies, but we get much deeper, deeper origins, and we get the whole journey that led them up to the to where they are in the film. And they're really interesting, very different, and I've been having a really great time working on it. Really great time working on it. And Bruce has been a delight so far to work with, so I have no complaints there.
Yeah, it's great. It's really fascinating. It seems one of the biggest stories to come out of this Batman and Robin movie was that teaser for Gods and Monsters, and there's a lot of excitement about it. So so you're saying this process, they're giving you the basic outline, the basic origin for each character, but you're plotting a full origin and then
in the movie, like, you'll know how Batman became Batman, but in the comic, there's a lot more than that initial incident that turned him into Batman. You know what I mean? So what, how did he get, where is his journey from that moment he becomes Batman to later when he becomes Batman in the Justice League, you know? And the same thing with Superman. We get a basic sense of how Superman came to be in the movie, but here we basically get his whole life, you know, his whole life. And without getting into things, you know, from the time he was a child. And the same thing with Wonder Woman. We get to see all kinds of things that we didn't get a chance to see. And I got to invent a whole lot of great stuff, which, you know, if they get to do new movies, well, hopefully some of this stuff will get folded into the movies. So I got to be a real participant in the creation of these characters and of this world, and or the post-creation, because obviously they already existed. And I should say the deepening of these characters. How's that? And the deepening of their mythology. But again, the bottom line was, if Bruce said, nah, I don't want to go there, it's Bruce's characters and Bruce's world. We're not going to go there. But he hasn't been the kind of guy who's sitting there going, no, I don't want to do that. No, I don't. He's been very, very open, very collaborative, and, you know, has only drawn that line in the sand a couple of times. So it's been really, it's been a fun process and sort of a fun, unexpected project that just kind of popped up and has turned into a lot of fun.
Right, and you're no stranger to alternate versions of Justice League, because Justice League 3000.
I know, it's kind of funny. I was thinking about that the other day. Here I am working with all, you know, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman on these two different projects, and they're all alternate versions, you know? Even though, you know, technically our guys are the real people, but they've been through so much that they're completely different. So it's so interesting, and it goes back to what we were saying before about the way you can bend these iconic characters so many different ways. And the Wonder Woman that's in Justice League 3000, which is now just going to be Justice League 3001, and the Wonder Woman in Gods and Monsters, very different, and yet they're both Wonder Woman. The Batman, very different, yet they're both Batman. The Superman, very different, and yet in their own way, they're both Superman. You know, it's fascinating. These characters really can bend and twist in a lot of different ways, and yet somehow, as we were saying, remain essentially true to the core.
Mm-hmm. And I was surprised to see, glad to see that Justice League 3000 is one of the titles that will continue after Convergence.
Yes, I am too. Very much so. Very much so.
Now, are you basically continuing the storyline you had set up before and taking a break through Convergence? Or is this one of the titles where Convergence really shifts things?
No, Convergence didn't really shift anything for us at all. Because really, in a way, we were Convergence pre-Convergence, because what we really kind of clearly established is that the universe that we're in is not the new 52 DC universe. You know, Keith and I always say our stuff has always existed in its own universe anyway. This really is Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman from the classic Justice League, but it's our take on it, and that's the thing. You know, comics, there has to be room for just, like, it's a comic. It's Superman, it's Batman, it's Wonder Woman. Do you have to worry about where it fits in continuity? Or that kind of stuff can drive you crazy after a while. So, you know, this is our, you know, we call it the Blah-ha-ha-haniverse or something. You know what I mean? It's like, it's our world. And, you know, we have Supergirl coming in. It's the classic Supergirl, you know? It's that Supergirl that you know, who came from Krypton, who's Superman's cousin. That's who Supergirl is. If someone wants to bang their head against the wall trying to figure out where that fits in continuity, go right ahead. But it doesn't really bother us, so, you know?
So then would you say that Justice League 3000 and Justice League International are part of the same world, or is it just...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely. As far as we were concerned, this book is a direct sequel to I Can't Believe It's Not the Justice League. That's the last time you saw our characters in that universe. And then you see them again here. You know, that's why when Beetle and Booster show up, that's the Beetle and Booster from I Can't Believe It's Not the Justice League. They're not the Beetle and Booster from the Max Lord Blew My Brains Out.
Right.
In our universe, never happened.
Is that a personal vindication for you?
A vindication? No, I don't know if I'd call it a vindication. You know, that's like that kind of, I hear vindication, it's like I'm standing on a hilltop shaking my fist. I'm vindicated. No, not at all. It's just, we're just happy to be working with our characters the way that we left them. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. And yeah, I got to tell you, you know, it always amazes me with, especially with like Beetle and Booster and these classic JLI characters. We step away from them for years. When we did formerly known as the Justice League, we hadn't touched those characters in 10 years. We started working on them and it was like, oh my God, it was like 30 seconds ago since we wrote this before, but it had been 10 years. And when we did this whole solo issue with Beetle and Booster, it's like we never stopped. It was so easy. Talk about effortless. Writing those characters for me in many ways is really effortless. All I have to do is start them talking, and then they don't shut up. And I just have to write down what they say. You know what I mean? That's what it feels, especially with Beetle and Booster. They just start talking to each other, and I'm like, oh, I didn't know that. Really? Oh, okay, cool. And off we go. So it's been really great. And so we've got Fire and Ice back. And then what you'll see, which I can't give away, once we get into 3001, I will say that things sort of break off into two separate groups. And if you remember, and I can't believe it's not the Justice League, they call themselves the Super Buddies. And so prepare for the return of the Super Buddies.
And both teams will be in Justice League 3001?
Yes.
Okay.
And I've just told you things I haven't told anybody publicly, so aren't you?
Oh, thank you so much. I knew we were friends for a reason.
You know, part of you all the time, you're going, well, we shouldn't tell people this because, but the truth is, in this market, you know, where books just die so easily, you know, Keith convinced me of this. Of course we should give some of this stuff away and let people know. We want them to know. It's like, you know, there was a period of like, well, should we hide Beetle and Booster until they just show up? No, we want people to know they're going to be there because then they're going to buy the book. You know? So even though you're not going to see a lot of Beetle and Booster in the first couple of issues, by I think issue 3, we're going to be back with them and, you know, and seeing what they're up to. Although Fire and Ice show up in the first issue, so that's, you know, we get to check in with them. And it's great because it's those characters, but they've grown, they've changed. You know, Ice has been around for 1,000 years, and she's seen a lot of hard stuff. So she's the Ice that we know, but she's been changed by time, and Fire has been through a pretty traumatic thing. She's been living in hell for 1,000 years, so she's our Fire, but she's been through it. Beetle and Booster, not so much. They're pretty much the same as they were before. Thank God, you know.
Is Beetle fat or thin now?
He's in good shape.
Okay.
Yeah, he's not the chubby Beetle. Yeah.
Now, as you said, when you come back to these characters after 10 years, are you so connected with them that you do just start writing them, or do you need to reference your own work?
You know, I really don't need to. I mean, I will, literally to reference certain events, I'll go look up things and what was that? What did they do there? And I want to, you know, because they want to talk about this that happened or whatever. But in terms of just the characters and the essence of who they are, you know, Keith understands them and, you know, he writes the plot and it's all there on the page. And then, like I say, I start spinning the top and I get them talking and I don't have to worry about a thing, especially with those two. Get them talking and they take care of themselves. I don't have to reference anything or look anything up. And then they show me how they have grown or changed or evolved, you know? So it's really fascinating to me, which as a writer, it's always fascinating to me. The process is really always about getting out of the way and letting the characters take care of the story themselves. The more I can get myself out of the way, the better the story is going to be. And then I'll come back in the end and be the editor and clean up some sloppy stuff or whatever. But really, I have to get out of the way and just let them talk and let them act. Because every time, you know, my other metaphor is like, you know, you're on a horse and you see the goal in the distance. Come on, horse, we're going that way. But the horse is galloping off in a whole other direction. And you're trying to force the horse to go that way. As a writer, anytime you force the horse to go the direction you want him to go, you're going to lose. You have to let the horse gallop off and follow the horse, you know? And then the stories will surprise you and the characters will surprise you. And if they surprise you, hopefully they surprise the readers as well.
Yeah, that's always interesting. Now, how far can you take that? I mean, if if you're going in a direction you weren't expecting before, that impacts the plot. You just change. Are you just changing the plot and the basic outline and going, well, this is really where the story wants to go? Or are there parameters?
Yeah, sometimes you do. Mm-hmm. What often happens is the basic structure holds, you know. I always imagine like three big poles, you know, one at the beginning, one in the middle, one at the end, and there's like a rope, you know, holding them all. And that's the big structure of the story. But within the space between the first pole and the second pole and the second pole and the final pole, so many things can change. And you might think, oh, I know they're walking this path, they're going this way, this will happen, that 100 other things happen, and you have to let the story go there. And occasionally, one of those poles gets completely kicked over, and you get a new pole. And you have to let the story do that. You have to let the story do that. You can't be so entrenched you say, no, my story has to end over here. It has to. And I'm going to force my characters to do what I want them to do. You can't. You can't.
Yeah, that's great. Now, I know we talk about how busy you are. What did we not talk about that you're working on now or that's coming out or that's out that
The things that I can talk about, Justice League 2001's out, The Gods and Monsters, working very slowly. I did a creator-owned thing for IDW a couple of years ago called The Adventures of Augusta Wynn. We're working on a sequel to that. I'm working on a top secret TV project that I can't talk about yet that's very exciting.
Is that as a freelancer or is that more on a producer level?
I can't even get into it.
Oh, okay. I got one exclusive out of you. That's okay.
Right. This one I can't talk about because it's very exciting and I can say no more, you know?
Okay.
I've just amazingly just written some episodes. There's a new, they're doing a new Scooby-Doo series. And I never thought in a million years I'd end up working on Scooby-Doo. And Michael Jelinek, who I work with on a lot of different animated shows, from Legion of Superheroes to Brave and the Bold to Teen Titans Go, is involved with it. So he got me involved with it. And I had the best time. You know, I'm writing Scooby-Doo, really? And it was great because they have such a great take on the characters. I've written three episodes so far already, and that was really, really a tremendous amount of fun, and I think it's going to be a really fun and very funny show.
It seems like lately Scooby-Doo and DC within Warner Brothers, there's like an open door between the two, because I know Alan Burnett's written some.
Yeah.
The DVDs. Is it the same team that Warner Brothers Animation handling both, or is there just
Alan Burnett's not involved with it, but like I said, Jelinek, but another different group of people. I worked a lot with a really, really smart, funny, talented writer named John Barry, who's overseeing a lot of the show, and he's great. He's really great. Really loved working with him, and it was more fun that I could ever have imagined. it really was. Because I Scooby-Doo was the same thing. Like, you know, what do you know about Court of Owls? Nothing. How much you know about Scooby-Doo? I've seen a couple of them, you know, so you immerse yourself in the world and you see what their new take is. They let you see some episodes and you get the feeling and then you learn as you go. And if you're a professional and you've been doing it long enough, you learn how to adapt. As I said, it was a blast, and I hope I get to do more, and I hope the show is a big success. I may not be on till the fall or something. I don't think it's going to be on for a while, but it was great because I got to work out my silly self, you know. Mm-hmm. They're really looking for like a sort of a Monty Python Marx Brothers-y take on these characters in that world. So that's right up my alley. You know, I love that stuff. But it's the same thing working with Keith. It allows me to unleash that part of myself. I can get as goofy as I like, you know, and we get to be our little, we call ourselves neo-vaudevillians, you know, and so we get to do our little vaudeville shtick on the comic book page.
And how's Imagination Workshops? Is there another workshop coming?
You know, I did one maybe, must be 6 months ago now. And I would love to do another one. I'm so busy that I don't have the time right now, but I'm sure at some point, and maybe in the latter part of 2015 or early part of 2016, I will, because I don't like to let too much time go by, because I find I kind of get involved with my work and I forget about the workshops. And then I do one, and I did another one, like I said, maybe 5-6 months ago. And I remember how much fun they are. We did an Imagination 201, which is the second level, which is a 4-day writing intensive workshop. And I just had such a great time. And I found each and every time I've done one of these, just the nicest people showing up for these workshops. Really good, decent, open-hearted, creative people who are really are there to learn and have fun. And so, and I always end up learning as much as they have or more, you know, by the time the weekend is over. So I'll absolutely be doing more of these, and people should just check the workshop page on my website. And when I get the next one together, I will post it there.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, and speaking of your website, I know we got to let you go. I do not want to keep you later. I know you have to go. But how can we find you online?
JamDeMatteis.com. I'm on Twitter a lot. I really enjoy Twitter. And what we've just done, I'm like so late to this party, like, you know, 15 years later or however long. I just set up a Facebook page as well. So
it's unusual that you were on Twitter before Facebook.
Yeah, because I was not really that interested in social media. And someone said, oh, check it out and try it. And I got onto Twitter and had the best time. You know, I've had such a great time on Twitter. It allows me to really interact with the people that read and appreciate my work in a really wonderful way, not to mention with other professionals that I've connected with in ways that we never have.
You and I met on Twitter talking about the Beatles.
Right. So, and what I've done with the Facebook thing is just really kind of set it up so all my blog posts, my Twitter feed, all show up on Facebook. So if someone is more Facebook-centric, they'll get that information over there. If they're Twitter-centric, you know, come on over to Twitter. But one thing I will say with Twitter also is, you know, if you're going to want to communicate with me and you're going to talk to me on Twitter, I'm going to do my very, very best to come back and communicate with you in return. That's one of the things I really, really enjoy about it, is a chance to talk to people that are reading the work and appreciate the work. And, you know, we're writers. We sit in a room alone by ourselves most of the time. So to have that little door that opens to the people that are reading the work is a really nice thing. So Facebook, Twitter, and the website, between all those, if you're looking for me, you can find me.
You can follow me at Not In My Book on Twitter. That is the Caffeinated Comics Twitter feed. Like us on Facebook. A lot of things going on Facebook. And Steven's shop is 19 South LaGrange Road in LaGrange, Illinois. We will talk to you next week.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not In My Book production.